thanks for inviting me again, Richard. I appreciate it. I want to thank Eric also, our power's not here right now, but for inviting me back. I had a great time last year. What I'm going to talk about here this morning is kind of another angle of the global warming conversation, but more tied into some of the controversy, where we are now with global warming. It's a very complicated subject, I'm sure many of you can appreciate. And one of the real lingering issues that we have not gotten a good handle on, as you'll see, is the role of clouds. And there's been a lot of controversial studies published fairly recently about the role of clouds. Many people feel like it's sort of, in many ways, clouds are the Earth's thermostat. And what happens to cloud coverage in the future in response to the warming that we're experiencing now is sort of going to be the ultimate determining factor in many ways as to which direction we go. And I'll explain that in a few minutes. As Richard said, I'm over at UW-Whitewater. And the work I'm going to show you here, it's a little bit of this and that, things I've been working on over the last 5 years. I'm going to start with some of the more recent things that I'm really, to be honest with you, mostly just dabbling with right now. I've gone to the dark side, so to speak, into the administrative position on campus, so I haven't had as much time for research as I previously had. So what you're going to see is work in progress initially, and then some things that have been published following that. So one of the big issues, people ask me all the time, why is this global warming conversation so complicated? Why have we not kind of come to a resolution on whether global warming is a legitimate problem or not? And it's become very political, as I'm sure you know. It's embedded with a lot of money issues and politics. Well, one of the reasons is it's really two separate questions. The first question is simply more about, is global warming actually happening? The second question is, if the answer to the first question is yes, then what is the cause? And really, there are two separate questions. And we're getting closer to coming up with a convincing yes with an exclamation point to the first question about global warming. Is it for real? And one of the things that I'm looking at is sort of the geographer's take on looking at spatial coverage of abnormal temperatures. And what I want to show you here, just as a couple slides at the beginning, just hearkening back to some of the days, go back to the first couple there, Richard, if you could. The first couple days, some of the sort of famous seasons of the 20th century that I'm sure many of us remember, where we had, for instance, in the winter of 1978, extreme cold in the eastern U.S. What this map shows is the difference from the mean temperature over the previous 30-year period for temperatures during that winter. And you can see wherever there's blue, the darker purple here, temperatures were much, much colder than normal. And people often remember that winter for being abnormally cold. But what they don't remember is in the West, it was actually abnormally warm. If you go to the next slide, summer of 1983, another season that stands out in many people's minds, a very warm, hot summer here in the Midwest, record high temperatures, well above normal when compared to the mean. But we had other places in the country which were actually well below normal. Go to the next slide. For a full year, here's an example of a typical looking sort of mean value for a year compared to normal. Western part of the country, much warmer in 1963. Eastern part of the country, much colder. Now, we'll go to one more slide, Richard. 1996, sort of one of the last years where we look at full year data, and we see this sort of oscillation, in a sense, almost symmetry between above and below normal temperatures. 1996, the east, northeast part and northern part of the country, well below normal. Southwest and western part of the country well above normal. And one of the reasons for this, and we understand this quite well in meteorology, is because the jet stream, which really controls our weather, sometimes gets locked into a pattern, a very persistent pattern, which causes a persistence of abnormality in one direction or the other. In this case, we'd have a big ridge in the west and a trough here in the central and eastern part of the country. And if it persists for an extended time period, and during 1996, we had this pattern continuously come back and lock itself in, we end up getting a pattern of abnormality that looks something like this. This is basically nature kind of controlling things and offsetting itself in a sense, where you have a well above versus well below. If you took the country as a whole, you would actually see that 1996 as a whole for the lower 48 US was not that abnormal, because the lows kind of offset the highs and vice versa. Now go to the next slide. And we see 2005, which is sort of the new pattern that's emerging, and that is a pattern of consistently above normal temperatures for the entire country. This was the first year in the past 50 years that we had no states, and we often do this by state, as opposed to doing it like you see here. We had no states in the lower 48 that had temperatures at or below normal. Every single state in the country, in the lower 48 at least, was above normal for 2005. And so what we're lacking here is that offsetting coverage of below normal temperatures. And what's particularly disturbing to me, and I don't have time to go into the details meteorologically here, but we did have kind of a ridge trough pattern in 2005, which should have provided cooler temperatures in the east, and provided that offsetting pattern, which really didn't exist. So one of the things I'm looking at with some current research I'm working on is the background warming that's going on with greenhouse gas forcing and the whole mechanism which we think is causing global warming. Is that overriding the effects of the jet stream in some areas, which would otherwise provide a cooling availability? So one of the things that I did, what I've been doing, is looking at the past 50 years, both the seasons and the years as a whole, and calculating ratios between above normal and below normal temperature to see if that ratio, that pattern, is changing. And so go to the next slide, Richard, and just to show you a quick little result here. This is the past 50 years, well, from 55 or so up to 2005. Notice what's happened here. In the first sort of 30 years or so, the ratio was very close to zero. Now, I had to do some normalization here to get this number centered around zero, but this is the real spatial coverage of areas above normal over areas below normal, basically divided, very simple here. And you can see that, yes, we did have some oscillation back and forth, but more or less, the pattern hugged the zero mark here, indicating that more or less we had areas that were above normal offset, at least partially offset, by areas below normal and vice versa for most years. And then in the mid-80s, things started going crazy. And we had these amazing spikes of very, very positive values, indicating much, much larger above normal temperature regions than below normal temperature regions. And what you can actually see here are a couple different spikes. And these are leading up to 10-year periods from 1990, and then a bit of a cool down. 2000, a bit of a cool down. And the reason for that is we're correcting for the comparison period that we're calculating our numbers against, because the 30-year period that we compare against changes every 10 years. And so what you're seeing here is a bit of a correction factor, and then it goes back up again, then a bit of a correction factor, and it goes back up again. But the bottom line is we're seeing a definite change here in the spatial coverage of above normal temperatures. If there are any questions or comments on this, I can come back to this later, but I just wanted to show you this as a starting point to kind of put things in perspective, that we do see evidence in the data record that things are dramatically changing. The cause of that is still out there in terms of a lot of a controversy and a lot of debate. Let's go to the next slide. And I'll go back to what I mentioned at the beginning, which is this big question, the role of clouds. Very complicated. There was an article published in Discover magazine a month ago, a feature article on a scientist over in Europe who's been doing some very important research arguing that global warming is being caused by changes in cloud cover, not by anything we're doing here, because the changes in cloud cover are a response to changes in sunlight. His argument is that as the energy from the sun changes, it has the ability to change the amount of cloud cover that we have. And if the energy, if the strength of the sun from the energy changes, you can get a reduction in cloud cover and you get actual warming that takes place. So it's the opposite. You get a slight reduction in sunlight, you get an increase in warming because the clouds are able to be formed to block the sunlight and reflect it. But one of the things that really was he neglected to talk about in the article, and I've seen this in a number of places and other similar types of studies, is the fact that we really have two distinct types of clouds on the planet. In broad categories, high clouds and low clouds, the type that we've all seen. And they have a very different type of effect on the temperature at the Earth's surface. High clouds have much more of a blanketing, trapping ability, kind of like what greenhouse gases do. They allow sunlight through, don't really block out much sunlight. They have very low albedos, relatively speaking, but they trap energy, especially at night, that's trying to get out. So they act like a blanket. They tend to warm the Earth. Low clouds, on the other hand, much brighter, water-laden, very thick, and they reflect sunlight, and that's why they look so dark to you and I at the below their bases, and they tend to cool the Earth because they're so close to the Earth's surface, they allow energy to get through because the temperature difference between the base of these clouds and the ground isn't as great as the difference between the base of those clouds and the Earth's surface. So we know that clouds have a differing effect. We know that there are certain areas where high clouds are much more common, certain areas where low clouds are much more common. For instance, we tend to think that the continents have clouds that dominantly warm the Earth. The oceans have a lot of lower stratus-type clouds. They tend to cool the Earth. And the ebb and flow of these high clouds and low clouds does act as sort of like a thermostat. And one of the things that I'm very interested in is how are clouds changing today? We know the world's a cloudier place. Part of the reason is because it's a warmer place. There's more evaporation. There's more condensation as a result. There are also more pollutants. When we talk about hybrid vehicles and the cleaner types of emissions that we get by using hybrid vehicles, one of the things that we're stopping from happening is the emission of particulate pollutants that are able to act as condensation nuclei, basically the foundation for cloud formation. And we know that cities, because they're more polluted, are cloudier. Areas downwind of cities are cloudier. But the question is, what is this doing to the Earth's radiation balance? How is this affecting the temperature of this increase in cloud cover? Taking it a step further, we're artificially creating clouds as well. And one of the things that I've studied in particular are jet contrails, condensation trails emitted by airplanes as they pass through supersaturated atmospheres, usually around 30,000 feet or so above the surface. And the problem with contrails is, first of all, they're increasing rapidly. And I'll show you some alarming statistics here in a few minutes that show dramatic increases of jet contrail coverage across certain parts of the world, particularly right here in the Midwest, where we live. We have one of the biggest increases of contrail coverage because of the flight traffic patterns over the central part of the country. But the other complicated problem with these is that they're high clouds. So you'd think initially they would maybe act like natural high clouds and warm the Earth's surface. But they're also very bright clouds. You've all seen bright jet contrails on a sunny day. You can see that bright white against the blue sky. And even as they spread and persist, the brightness might dissipate, but they're still much brighter than natural cirrus clouds. And so in many ways, they have the ability to do both. Warm the Earth and cool it by reflecting sunlight. And so one of the things we're trying to kind of work our way through is figure out what is the net effect of jet contrails and how much of a player are they in the bigger question mark with overall cloud changes. Because we know these are not going to go away. We know they're increasing. And I'll show you some data on that as we go through. Okay. One of the things that I use for my research more than anything else is satellite imagery. And go ahead and click on it again, Richard. And you can see, here's a satellite picture from a polar orbiting satellite. This is called AVHRR imagery. And I wanted to show you this because here we are in Madison. This is a satellite image of, obviously, Wisconsin, Lake Michigan. And this is a picture taken at the same time from the ground. And you can actually see the difference here in the perspective of what we can get by looking at satellite imagery versus from studying contrails from the ground. You can really pick these out pretty clearly on satellite imagery, intermixed often with natural high clouds, but the linear, kind of all over the place characteristic of these clouds, these contrails, makes them very distinctive from satellite imagery. Go ahead and flip through this one. I've got a few. You'll have to just keep toggling down there. So two primary impacts, or influences, from aircraft on climate. I'm going to mostly focus on the second, but I don't want to leave this one behind without making a comment about it. Certainly pollution from airplanes is a big player here. As a matter of fact, in terms of the total contribution to greenhouse gases, aviation is rapidly becoming the biggest player. In terms of technological changes such as hybrid vehicles and the technology that we're doing here at the surface, in industry, transportation, even in your own homes, in terms of improving and making things greener, we're not really doing it, at least certainly not at the same pace, for aviation. The reason for that is because it's simply we can't afford to right now. Airlines are going bankrupt. People want to get as quickly and cheaply as possible. And so aviation is gradually becoming the biggest player in terms of pollution contributions here. And you can see three of them I've listed there for you under the heading of pollution. Impacts on clouds. This is really what I'm mostly interested in, the sources of impacts, the contributions. I'll go back real quick, Richard. Sorry. There we go. So again, contrails, that's the visible impact that we can see from clouds produced by airplanes. And just to kind of give you something to put in mind here about total coverage of contrails, we've done some analysis and published some work in simply totaling up total contrail coverage on a single day over the lower 48 U.S., and it's approximately the size of Montana. If you took all those contrails and put them all together, that's the aerial coverage of contrails. So we're not talking about a small little skinny line in the sky, which is mostly what people think about when I tell them I do research on contrails. They say, those little lines in the sky, well, you know, how can that be a big deal? But when you add them all up and when you start to think about some of them persisting and spreading across the sky for hours before they dissipate, and then you start thinking, well, on a daily basis, coverage the size of Montana, you're talking about a significant contribution here, influence on the radiation balance. The other big thing here is global dimming. And global dimming is something that has been out in the media and in the research area, research fields a lot here in the last couple of years. And this was something that was highlighted on NOVA a few years ago, which I think Richard mentioned at the beginning, was some of my research was on there. And the whole topic of global dimming is very controversial because the thinking is that as particulate pollutants have increased, as some of the cooling effects of contrails have increased, particularly in certain parts of the world, the strength of the sunlight striking the Earth's surface has been reduced, thus the term global dimming, and that may have been offsetting some warming that otherwise would have been occurring years ago, sort of masking the effects. And now that we're starting to clean some of this up, not all of it, but some of it, we're starting to see a spike in the warming pattern. So that's sort of one of the big conversations going on right now in this climate change field related to global dimming. All right, keep toggling through this. We'll just put all these up here. So a couple of things to comment. Military concerns, if there was a way to solve the contrail problem, it would have been done by the military years ago. This is a real problem, particularly during World War II and in the Korean War, and even in Vietnam, with high-altitude bombers giving away their location by their contrail. And the military has worked for years to try to find a way to create an airplane that would not produce a contrail, and have had really no luck. We've come to find out that all it takes is a tiny sliver of water to be, it's like you walking out on a cold day and not trying to see your breath. I mean, it's impossible to hide it. You have to breathe and you have to exhaust warm vapor into a cold atmosphere, same thing as airplanes at a much higher scale. On top of that, the turbulence of the wingtips and the propellers, sometimes even with non-engine types of airplanes, turboprop planes can produce condensation trails. It's really the turbulence trails, a different name in a way for those. But bottom line is we've been looking at these for about 50 years, trying to figure out how to stop them from happening, and also looking at the atmospheric controls, what causes them sometimes to show up, and other times not show up at all, or to evaporate or sublimate within seconds behind an airplane. My interests are more in the climatic impacts, the cloud cover increases, the influences they have on the Earth's surface temperature. And then this big report came out in the late 90s. This was published by the same group that published the widely publicized report earlier this year on global warming happening at a very, very rapid pace and all the sort of projections to the future, which I think scared a lot of people. The IPCC also in the late 90s published this report on aviation being one of the big, big players in understanding future climate change. And this has really generated a tremendous amount of attention since then for this type of research. Okay, keep going. So just a couple more things here of text, and then we'll go on to mostly just pictures. The major contributors to contrail increases. Well, no doubt about it, increased air traffic. We've had tremendous increases by more than 200% in miles flown. We have over 25,000 flights a day in the United States alone. That's a lot of airplanes in the sky. A lot of airplanes are flying at higher altitudes. The designs, the engine specifications allow that. That means they're flying in colder temperatures with higher relative humidities, which means that they're more prone to producing contrails that persist. And there are also changes going on. Don't forget, while the surface has warmed up, if greenhouse trapping is causing the Earth's surface to warm, what that means is the heat that otherwise would be getting up into the higher levels of the atmosphere isn't getting there. So in the upper troposphere, the areas near where airplanes cruise, it's actually gotten colder as that heat's been trapped below the airplanes by the greenhouse gases. That's also making it more ideal for contrails to form and persist. And this could be tied to global warming, as I mentioned. All right, next slide. Okay, so here are some satellite images. It's going to give you an idea of truly how much contrail coverage we have. It's kind of hard to see, but in the upper left corner there, you probably can't pick it up. There's the bottom tip of Lake Michigan. Some of you might be able to see that. And down here in the far bottom right corner would be the east coast, southeast coast of South Carolina. So we're talking about basically almost the entire eastern half of the U.S. And every one of these straight lines would just about, at least, would be jet contrail. So it kind of gives you an idea. If you took the airplanes out of the sky on this particular day, how bright and sunny it would have been. But instead, we've got, well, at least a 50% overcast, if not more in some areas. This has got to be having some sort of influence on the radiation balance. Next one. Oh, she skipped one, just to pop it back. Here we go. Here's another example. These are contrails from the west. This would be the Baja of California. And you can see some natural clouds, no doubt about it, on this image, but also the straight lines, again, streaking across the country. We've measured contrails in length of over 1,000 miles from point A to point B. You can almost follow the flight trajectory of a single airplane by its contrail. This has actually caused, particularly following September 11th, this has caused some concern for security, and I'll show you an image later which will kind of maybe make you chuckle a little bit, but you can actually track the flight trajectory of a plane by its contrail. And I'll never forget, not long after the White House kind of initiated some new protocol on tracking and monitoring flight movements, there was an airplane that flew out of Mexico. Some of you may have heard about this. And there was a contrail that they could see on some of the real-time satellite imagery, which the public typically doesn't have access to. Anyway, this contrail was identified as a rogue contrail, and there was no flight plan connected to that path. And the military actually launched jets to investigate. And this poor little pilot who was flying out of Mexico, and I guess somehow he went off flight plan or he forgot to file a flight. I'm not sure how he got high enough to produce a contrail. But anyway, they almost ordered this guy to land because they had no idea exactly who he was. And they've actually softened that a little bit since then, but just to give you an idea that you can see contrails for a lot further length satellite imagery wise than you might think.
What was this guy flying?
I don't know. I actually have no idea, but it's a good question. Again, the producer contrail of that magnitude. Yeah, and
we heard it might be a poop.
It's a rumor.
Well, yeah, you never know. And then here's another image. This is we tend to refer to these as outbreaks or super outbreaks. It's a little dramatic, I realize. But the idea in many ways is that the atmosphere will provide almost out of nowhere, seemingly, the ideal ingredients. Like an air mass will move over an area, settle in, the moisture content will get ideal. And if you fly airplanes through it regularly, like we do in most of the lower 48 U.S., all of a sudden contrails start to pop up like a disease or like bumps on something, and it's like an outbreak. And then all of a sudden, when we come up with a cure for the disease, it just goes away very magically as the air mass characteristics change. So it's not the number of flights necessarily. We have plenty of flights all over the lower 48 U.S. nowadays. It's the air mass that they're flying through. And sometimes you get such an ideal set of conditions that you get a very dense network of contrails as you would get here in southwestern Southern California, some more over here over the Rockies or the Sierras, but you can see clearly very dense outbreaks of contrails showing up sometimes. Okay. Just to show you quick, just some analysis here on changes in frequency to give you an idea of how much they're increasing. So this is some research that was just recently published, and this is a contrail frequency from the late 70s. Go to the next map. This takes you to the early 2000 period, dramatic increases. If you go to the next map, you can see we use something called GIS, which some of you might be familiar with, to average from each other, and we can get an idea of where the increases happened the most. We've actually seen some decreases, oddly enough, in parts of the West, and that sort of created a new round of research in terms of trying to understand the major controls on contrail increases. One of the things we learned from this study, as I mentioned a minute ago, is it's not no longer number of flights in the atmosphere above us. It's now about the air masses and how the conditions above us are changing. And in the East, we've seen dramatic increases. In the West, we've seen just subtle increases, or in some spots, even slight decreases. Go to the next slide. This is what we think is causing this. This is a map that shows changes in the temperature where airplanes cruise, more or less, an area we refer to as the tropopause. And in the eastern part of the country, we've had dramatic cooling. And that ties into that global warming piece I mentioned a few minutes ago, as we've trapped air below us. But in the West, because of the pattern of the jet streams and how that shifted in response to, we believe, global warming, there hasn't been as much cooling. And there's actually been a slight warming in some parts, especially once we get off the coast. So we do believe that is now one of the biggest controls on future changes in contrail frequency. It's not so much additional increases in flights. There are plenty of them out there. The projections are a doubling by the year 2025, from 25,000 to 50, if not 50,000, if not sooner. So there will be even more. But we believe at this point it's all about the conditions that they're flying through, not so much about the number of flights that are up there. OK, Richard. Let's go to the last little piece here. And I'm just going to talk about this little section here. This is kind of the part that's of most interest, I think, in that we've learned a lot about contrails and their influences, but we weren't able to do any real rigorous type of analysis because there are so many contrails. When we've had people fly to them and try to measure changes in the conditions above and below them as a way to try to estimate changes in radiation passing through them. Go to the next one, Richard. We've had, that's the in-situ observations. We've had physical modeling studies. We've compared locations with dense contrail coverage. The next one, we've used satellite interpretation. But to be honest with you, we didn't really have an opportunity to do a real control study. Go to the next, hold on there. We didn't have an opportunity to do a real control study because what we really needed was a time period where we could sort of step back 50 years in time or go and get an idea as to how much natural cloud coverage there was without jet contrails and what the range and temperature and the effects on the radiation balance were prior to the period of jet contrail, the aviation boom. And we really needed a day and a night, a full 24-hour period to be able to do this, to do a true control study. And we did it all sorts of, we tried all sorts of wacky ways to do this and actually published some articles somehow on that. But we weren't able to really do this until September 11th, where we had this sort of tragic opportunity in a way, following the terrorist attacks and the grounding of all US flights for 3 days for the most part. I mean, on that third day, they began to return slowly. But really, it was about three full 24-hour periods. This is the morning of September 11th, clear skies in the Northeast. Most of you probably recognize where we are here with the Great Lakes. And one of the reasons I show that, and then we zoom into this, is to make you realize how clear it was in the Northeast, which is one of the reasons they believe that the terrorists chose that day, so they could actually see, they didn't have to use the instruments in the cockpit to see the ground. They could navigate through visual inspection. We zoom into the Great Lakes region here, Lake Michigan. We can actually see that as this was unfolding, we actually did have little contrails crisscrossing over Lake Michigan. But around this time, this is when the FAA was ordering all airplanes to land. So what you're actually seeing here are a lot of short contrails, which would otherwise have been likely long contrails crisscrossing over Lake Michigan and through Michigan and Wisconsin. And this is indicative of flights that were probably at cruising altitude that were then asked in order to descend and went below cruising altitude. And one of the things you have to understand about contrails is they form when airplanes are at their cruising altitude, not when they're taking off and landing, unless you're in Alaska, where it's cold enough for them to form on the runway. But it's sort of in between the big airports where you get most of your contrails. And that's why in the Midwest, where we have the New York to LA type flights crossing over us at 35,000 feet, that's why we get so many jet contrails forming in this part of the country. On this day, we would have had them, at least this morning it appears, except for the fact that they were descending very rapidly. By the afternoon of the 11th, clear skies for the most part across the Midwest, a few natural clouds here and there. The 12th, same thing. Now I want to show you this because this is an image that you don't see anymore. This is a sort of snapshot from the bird's eye that you would not see in today's world, at least not here in the United States, in this part of the country. These are natural clouds with sharp edges to them. And one of the reasons I point, that's actually a little cold front sagging south from the north. One of the reasons I point this out is because jet contrails normally occur on the edges of natural clouds. That's where sort of nature's got most of the ingredients, high mountain moisture, some uplift, but not quite enough. And the airplanes fly through and sort of put them over the threshold, create the cloud, and then the atmosphere sort of takes over from them and there and keeps the cloud, the contrail, going. And these sharp edges are something that we just don't see. Go to the next slide and I'll show you an example of that. I went back through the archives of imagery and found this shot from September 11th, 1995, just for comparison. And it's different, I acknowledge it's different, but there are some similarities here. We did have kind of a weak cold front. And we had some settling down of natural clouds. But look how diffuse the areas are between the natural clouds with lots of contrails and sort of, I mean, a lot of linear type clouds crisscrossing here. And if we had a little higher resolution shot, you could see even better detail. But again, these sharp edges are something that we just don't see any longer. This is a more typical looking satellite picture. I always tell people, you can tell from contrail behavior changes in the weather that are likely to occur. Typically, if you see contrails forming and spreading and persisting at increasing lengths and time, often it means that a storm system or a front is approaching, and often in 24 hours or so, you may even have rain or snow. It's very indicative of a storm or a front approaching because that's where we typically find contrails forming the most. Okay, go to the next slide. There we go. Here's another shot in the afternoon. This is kind of just an interesting little thing. And I showed this last year, and I think some people got a kick out of this. I figured I'd show it again. This was from the morning of the 12th. Again, crystal clear across the northeast, an area where we know we would have had a lot of contrails from a lot of modeling studies that we've done. And also, we can see evidence here of military aircraft, because we know that the commercial flights were grounded. And we had this really thick contrail right in the middle. If you click on the next one, I think you'll see, I hope this is right. There we go. So this is a shot of that contrail from the ground. And you can get an idea of how wide this thing was from the surface. And those of you that were here last year might know the answer to this, but what do you think this is, those that weren't?
Air Force One,
right. And this is basically the Air Force One returning, and it gives you an idea, I think, of how serious the situation was, likely with airplanes flanked on both sides, military aircraft, and that one big, huge contrail sort of morphed together, and that caused a lot of controversy because it ended up getting published on the front page of the science section of the New York Times saying, you know, President Bush returns to the White House. And one of my colleagues at NASA just about lost his job because he was quoted as saying, yes, this is definitely the Air Force One returning to the White House. And unfortunately, it was a different time than we were told that the President returned to the White House. We were told the President returned the night before. This was like mid-morning on the 12th. And it showed the trajectory of the flight, and they really made a big deal about this. That particular image actually is gone from the archive of all the imagery that we used for research. It got yanked. So I've got it, though. Now, on the 12th, you can see here, as a matter of fact, you can actually see, this gives you an idea, this is actually the smoke plume from the World Trade Center tower still burning. You can see this from outer space. And then this is some remnants of those military contrails, but basically, clear skies in the northeast. Just a couple more slides here, and then we'll wrap up. This is indicative. Another angle we took on this research was simply looking for evidence that supported the hypothesis that contrails and cloud coverage were rampant in places outside of the lower 48 U.S. So this is the Canadian border area here. You can kind of pick out, I hope, some of the Great Lakes. To the north, lots of contrails. Airplanes were flying in Canada. An abrupt edge as we get across Lake Erie here into the lower 48. Again, because, you know, nature doesn't know boundaries. This is a boundary that's artificially created by the flights or lack of flights in the U.S. Another one in the west. We're kind of in the Puget Sound area here in Canadian near Vancouver, is western Canada. Again, contrails to the north, and right along the U.S.-Canadian border here we have. Well, basically an abrupt edge. Next, you can see the same thing. Oops, one more. contrails, clouds just north of the Canadian border, nothing to the south other than some low sort of stratus clouds there in the mountains. So clearly an edge to cloud coverage. Okay, so final slide here. And what does all this mean? Well, what we tried to do was to determine if this lack of clouds for 3 days, lack of artificial clouds in the lower 48 U.S. had any influence on the temperature. Because, if you go back to what I said towards the beginning, because we know contrails have that dual ability to, during the day, reflect a lot of solar radiation because they're pretty bright, but at night, trap energy below them because they're pretty high. Rather than looking at a net change in temperature, we looked at something called the diurnal temperature range, DTR, which is to try to determine simply if the range of temperature for 24 hours, daytime highs versus nighttime lows, suddenly jumped. The days got warmer because there were no contrails. The nights got cooler because there were no contrails to trap the energy in. So there was a spike in temperature range. And sure enough, this is compared to the 30-year norm, 30-year mean. We see this very distinct spike. This was the biggest change, 3-day change in temperature range for the lower, we took all weather stations that were available, over 4,000 in the lower 48 U.S. This is the biggest change in temperature range from a 3-day period to a 3-day period that we could find anywhere in the last 30 years. So maybe it's a coincidence. I think probably not. This is quite a dramatic spike, and it does indicate that we can measure, this is one of the first times we were actually able to measure a signal in our data record from jet contrail coverage, in this case, lack of contrail coverage. Okay, let's skip ahead to the last sort of wrap-up slide. Keep going, that's fine, we'll skip. This is just some modeling that we did, but we're running out of time. I think people are getting hungry for lunch. I know I am. So where does all this go? What are the conclusions here? Well, we think contrails do have the ability to affect cloud coverage. We do think they have the ability to affect temperature range. We think they're continuing to increase. And global scale climate change changes may be increasing the potential for contrail formation because global warming may be causing that layer where airplanes cruise to be cooling. So in some ways, it might be a positive feedback loop. If you think about it, if contrails, which we do believe in the end have a net warming effect, we think that warming outweighs the cooling, that dual effect I mentioned, and that helps to trap more heat below, making the layer which airplanes are cruising in cooler, this is like a positive feedback loop which would make it even more favorable for contrails to form in the future. It's a concern. The solutions, well, there really aren't any. Just go run through these. This will be the last slide. We can't reduce the number of flights. We're at this point way too dependent upon aviation and likely to continue going in that direction. They are working on engine design modifications. Actually, a company over in Germany developed an emissions-free, no-pollutant emission engine. I'm not sure how reliable it is when you're 30,000 feet, but they're working on it for aviation. That they still produce contrails because you can't propel something forward without having some stream of water vapor coming out at least a little bit, and then that's all it takes to get that contrail going. So engine design modifications, tricky at best to get anywhere, less water vapor and pollutants, but still does produce some contrails. Higher or lower altitudes is another problem because if we go much higher with airplanes, we get into the lower stratosphere, and we run into all sorts of problems with the ozone layer. Lower altitudes, we have noise. We have surface pollution from airplanes. So really, they're flying at about the ideal location. So final thing here, that's the last part, is what we're working on right now, which is a grant proposal, which is looking at the possibility of working with the airlines to have pilots, as part of their flight plan, not just consider point A to point B in the shortest route, but also not consider where severe weather might be, so they can fly around clusters of thunderstorms. But possibly, if we have the real-time modeling data available, which we think we do, avoid areas without, if it doesn't take too much time or expense from the flight, avoid areas that seem to have a high susceptibility for contrail formation and persistence on that particular day. Fly around these, adjust your altitude slightly. I mentioned this last year, I'll just repeat this. In England, there is now new policy being implemented that as you fly through British airspace, I should say, not just England, you have to lower your altitude by 5,000 meters. And one of the reasons behind that is because There have been studies published which demonstrate that by lowering their altitude as they fly through British airspace by 5,000 meters, there's over a 50% reduction in contrail formation. So they're keeping their skies sunnier as a result of this new policy. And I sort of would like to consider going in that direction here in the U.S., but I'll be honest with you, it's a struggle at this point to try to get the airlines to listen to these sorts of ideas with money being such a titan as it is. Okay, thank you.